Good morning. Are both counsel ready to proceed?
I am your honors.
Yes, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. The next case on our calendar today is A23-0192, Chase Rovere versus Clifford Ling et al., or Chase Rovere et al. Versus Clifford Ling et al. Hopefully, I pronounced the parties' names correctly. If I did not, please help me with the pronunciation when you start your argument. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument today. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording the oral argument today. I'll just remind everyone who's viewing that no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. A copy of the audio recording will be available on our website in approximately 24 hours. To counsel, there is also a timer available in the grid view that hopefully you can see that shows how much time you have remaining. And with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court.
Appellants, I should say. Sorry. Counsel for appellants.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Hertz. I am counsel for the appellants, the Lings. The problem with the trial court's decision was that it said no harm, no foul, when there were cognizable legal harms proven at trial. Now, there is a subtlety with the interplay of the contract and the deed that I think is worth addressing up front. As your honors probably noted in the briefs, there are points when the Lings argue the contract controls and points when they rely on the deed as superseding the contract. This is a subtlety, but not a contradiction. The terms of the life estate are set by the deed, but the Lings' right to that life estate comes from the contract. That life estate was part of the benefit of the bargain. So when we say that the Roveres can't rely on the future payoff date in the contract to claim there was no life estate because the deed subsumes the contract, that life estate in the deed is still a manifestation of the Ling's contractual rights. And Chase and Shelby's repudiation of it was a breach of the contract. And that brings us back to the first issue in this appeal. The trial court held that Chase and Shelby didn't breach the contract because they didn't succeed in evicting the Ling's. But renunciation of a contract is a breach. Chase and Shelby openly refused to uphold their end of the deal. They'd promised the Lings a life estate, and they broke that promise when they tried to evict the Lings and then drug
Ms.
them
Hertz,
to court.
can I clarify, when you say they didn't succeed, wouldn't it be more factually accurate they did not commence? Excuse me, I'm sorry. They did not commence an eviction. They threatened to, indeed, that by that letter, but they didn't actually commence it. And so, as I understood the court's analysis of that, that it just didn't get to that point. If they would have, then certainly you would have a straighter legal claim, I assume, to repudiation. But it seemed like the court ultimately in trial, in all its findings, gave some credit to the fact that there was a little bit of confusion or ambiguity, at least in plaintiff slash respondent's mind about it. Now, it didn't succeed in agreeing in terms of life estate, but the bottom line is all of this action, there was the parties were disputing, which led to declaratory judgment requests for the judge to clarify it. In a nutshell, in other words, that seems to be how I read the order and the court's analysis, which would seem to be legally sound.
Well, I think the distinction that we need to look at here is number one, what a life estate means, and number two, what the Roveres said to the Lings during the process of both inducing them to enter into the contract back in 2017 and inducing them to accept the payoff in 2020 and 2021. Again, the record demonstrates explicit promises that the Lings would be able to stay in their home, nothing would change, and they could live in their home as long as they wanted to. This was repeatedly promised. While the Roveres talk a lot about the subtleties, and as you said, arguably subtleties could be read into the contract, those quote unquote subtleties were not part of the discussions. Again, there were express promises. You're not going to leave. Nothing's going to change. You can stay. These promises were made. These were the discussions that were had. This was the understanding that the Lings not only had, but were led to have when they accepted the contract and when they accepted the payoff. And secondly, there's an understanding of what a life estate means. A life estate means that you are allowed to live there. You have your rights, and you can sit on those rights. You can enjoy those rights without interference. Once again, the representations made show that the Rovers understood exactly what it was they wanted the Lings to believe, i.e. that they would retain these rights, that no one would stop them from living there. They made representations to lead them down this road. And then as soon as things were uncomfortable for the Rovers, well, all of a sudden they bring up these quote unquote subtleties that were never discussed. And based on these subtleties, they interfered with the life estate rights. You know, served this eviction notice. That was certainly served. The fact that they ended up filing a declaratory judgment action after being informed by counsel that, hey, wait a minute, they are not tenants. They have a life estate. That doesn't absolve them of what they did. And really, when the representations were initially made by the Rovers, both with the contract and with the payoff, and when these representations were made explicit, the Lings should not have been forced to go to court to defend the rights that they were promised. And that is
so, counsel, did these arguments go to your argument with respect to the summary judgment order on the rescission claim or with respect to damages? Because we're looking at different standards of review between those two claims. And I think my question for you with regard to the summary judgment order on rescission is, whether you argued to the district court, or whether there was argument in front of the district court about this eviction notice being an anticipatory breach of the contract. Yes, they were not actually evicted, but they attempted to evict them, and that was an anticipatory breach of the life estate that was promised to your clients.
Your Honor, the argument before the district court, I believe, was that this entire course of conduct was a breach. Anything done to repudiate the life estate was a breach of the contract.
Are you saying anything that made the life estate uncomfortable was a repudiation? Because to me, removal of the life estate itself, I think that what the district court found was there was not a breach because they still retain their life estate today. And so I really do think that the district court was faced with the question of whether this eviction notice itself was an anticipatory breach of the life estate that was promised to your clients. Is that what was argued? I mean, that's my understanding of what the district court said. No actual removal means no actual breach for both the damages and the rescission claim.
That is what the district court ended up ruling. But again, the argument that we're making is at any point, not just with the notice, but with the lawsuit, these legal steps taken to end the life estate in flying in the face of the promises made leading up to the contract and leading up to the payment. Those are the things being repudiated by these actions to terminate the life estate and remove the Lings from the property.
Do you have any case law from Minnesota or even from other jurisdictions to support the concept that, in essence, what they're bringing is a quiet title action? We don't think that this is what the contract means, that by bringing that, you are repudiating the contract, that you're disputing the language, like what the meaning of the language is?
I do not have any case law saying that, but once again, what I believe really needs to be the focus here are the promises made as part of the contract. It is not merely the fact that they had a life estate and the Rovers come in here saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something that maybe we can dispute on the terms, and let's take this in front of the court and find out what the answer is. It is the fact that these disputes on the terms were never part of the discussion, and quite the opposite. The promises the Rovers made were of an absolute life estate. That is what was promised leading up to the contract. And essentially what's happening is they were promising another one thing while holding another in their minds to come back later and say, hey, we think there's a subtlety. Yeah, we didn't talk about it. But now that we've gotten you to do what we want, we are going to come back and use that subtlety to take away what we promised you.
But is it really repudiating the contract if they're not seeking to totally unwind the deal? In other words, they sought to evict the Lings, as I understand the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, they had already paid the full amount under the contract for deed. And, you know, they claimed that they thought that they then had the right to occupy the building themselves without the Lings. So it seems to me if you are seeking to repudiate or rescind a contract, you're trying to unwind the deal, but that's not what really was going on.
Well, they weren't trying to unwind the whole deal. They were only trying to unwind the Rovers were only trying to unwind the part of the deal that they now found inconvenient. And to have a breach of contract and to have a material breach, it doesn't need to be each and everything in the contract. Materiality is a question of whether it's a right of critical importance. And if you look at the record, being able to live in this property as long as they wanted, having a life estate, was a critical right to the Lings. It was so important to Cliff that he called the attorney multiple times to make sure that this right stayed in the contract. It was critical to him. It was material. The fact that the Roviers didn't like it that much, you know, that doesn't mean it's not material, and it doesn't have to be the whole contract to be repudiated. I mean, this as we stated in the briefs, if the Roviers had decided not to pay but left the Lings to live in their house, they couldn't have said, hey, you're living in the house, you know, why are you complaining about the money? It wouldn't work that way, and it doesn't work this way either.
Counsel, you only have a few minutes left, and I have a couple of questions for you regarding the Revere's breach of contract claim. Do you in any way challenge the district court's legal determination on the meaning of the words repair and maintenance and what that clause means in terms of the interaction between the as-is clause and the repair and maintenance clause?
I would challenge the district court's interpretation of repair and maintenance insofar as it means to fix something that was in existence at the time of the contract. Because what as-is means is you are buying things exactly as they are. You are taking it as a package deal. Repair and maintenance is to deal with problems that arise after the date of the contract.
Isn't that what the district court concluded? I mean, whether some of the things fit into that or not, but is your reading of the district court's order that they adopted your proposed interpretation that it has to be anything that arose after 2017 is what your clients were responsible for under the repair and maintenance clause?
Correct. My reading of the district court's opinion is that while the district court pays lip service to that and says, yes, it's got to happen after the contract for it to slip past that as is clause, its actual application requires my clients to pay for things that were in existence at the time of the contract and that the Roviers never offered proof arose after that.
So my next question is, I do believe that there is some testimony from your client that he agreed that things like painting and fixing boards that were broken fell within the repair and maintenance clause. It does seem like your client did think that there were some, you know, types of repairs that did fall within the purview, including things like painting, based on the testimony. Do you agree with that?
I would not agree with that on specifics. Again, as an overarching thing, if it was something that arose after the contract, if there was a painting issue that arose after the contract, if there was a broken board that arose after the contract, that is repair and maintenance. But if it's something that arose before the contract, simply the fact that my client said, yeah, paint, doesn't mean that it doesn't fall under the as-is clause.
And then my last question for you is, what evidence, if any, is in the record about what the house, what these properties looked like before 17? And what's your position on who had the burden to prove what the property looked like in 2017?
The burden of who had to prove that, that was most emphatically on the Roviers. They were the ones claiming breach of contract. So they had the burden of proof on what happened when. They had to come in and say, this is something that happened after the contract. As far as the evidence from before, the only ones offering pictures from before 2017 were my clients. And the evidence they offered showed things looked essentially the same prior to as it did afterwards. They didn't have the burden, but they did it. And the Roviers did have the burden and provided no such evidence of pre- and post-contractual changes. In addition, it is notable that Chase actually admitted on the stand he had no proof any of these issues predated the contract.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent Chase and Shelby Rovere, the respondents and cross appellants in this matter. I think the biggest issue here today is this is a contract. This was a contract that was made between the appellants, the Lings, and my client to create basically a contract for deed. And once that was done, a warranty deed was put in place that had further provisions. However, what didn't happen and what is an error as a matter of law for the court is this life estate, which the district court found specifically.
When you said further provisions, when you talked about the warranty deed, that same life estate language was included, correct?
We disagree that any life estate was made one with the contract and then would have continued within the warranty deed.
I understand your legal argument, but the point being is the same language, once the court ruled, and that's what we'll be reviewing on, was incorporated in the warranty deed. So your argument, which I understand you made for the first time to our court, that somehow when the contract for deed is paid off, that went away. But the point being is, it's in the warranty deed as well, the same language, correct?
I guess I want to be clear. I don't think this is the first time this argument has been made. We always found that there wasn't a life estate based on the plain language of both the contract and the warranty deed, and then the interpretation.
What I'm addressing, I just wanted to clarify the argument that it ended with the contract for deed. It factually isn't true in the sense that it was part of the warranty deed as well. I understand your point about the language, whether in both, but the point being is it obviously survived the contract for deed, whatever words were used, because it was part of the warranty deed, correct?
I guess I would say they were similar. I don't know if they were word for word the same. They were similar. I believe section H5 of what we were discussing is the right of occupancy and right. How it matters. But
Exhibit B to the warranty deed, I think the phrase hereby reserve the exclusive right to occupy the dwelling, shop, machine shed, green garage, and white shed located in the real estate for as long as they choose are physically able to do so. So that was in the warranty deed. And what part of that language does not create a life estate in your opinion?
So first, it's whether they choose and are physically able to do so. However, what is the contingent issue is that this section would contradict the other sections within the contract, and the warranty deed does not dispute that contract for deed would end upon the term of the payments.
Well, so, how does that conflict with anything? What in particular does it conflict with?
What it specifically conflicts with is there was a set term within the contract for deed that this full amount had to be paid by 2041. And upon that, and I believe it's section 4 of their contract for deed, my clients would then have the right to have occupancy of the home. They would get the home because they purchased it. There was no...
Where in the contract does it specifically say that? I see paragraph 4, the purchase price and the payment schedule, but I'm not sure I see the language that you're referring to that says they have an exclusive right to occupy the home upon completion of the payments, the full amount.
I believe on Exhibit 101, page 2, it was also discussed in testimony, I believe, transcript page 13, lines 1 through 5. There was a discussion that specifically said in section 4 that the contract required full payment by December 1st, 2041, that the exclusive right to occupancy was during this contract. And then
what I'm asking about, that's what I'm looking at is paragraph 4. And I don't see any language about an exclusive right to occupy in paragraph 4.
It's not in paragraph 4. It would be, we have to look at the contract as a whole. So,
right. So what where is that language then?
So the Groveries had the right to obtain possession in section 4 upon payment because they have the home. They are the owners of the home, which would contradict a life estate because they would not be able to obtain and occupy the home upon full payment if there was a life
estate. Ms. Olson,
what can you quote? I'm sorry, Judge Slater, can you point us to and quote the exact language that you're trying to rely on? Because you're suggesting that this contract has language that gives them an exclusive right to occupy. So we need to know exactly what you are relying on in making this argument. And I'm just still having trouble finding exactly what it is you're relying on. So if you could point us to the section and quote it, I would appreciate it.
Your Honor, I'm not saying that my clients had exclusive right to occupy. I said they had, I was talking about the Lings had rights to occupy the home until payment. And then once that happened, my clients had the right to obtain their home because they purchased it. So I think.
Okay, and so where is the language that says the right, the Lings have the right to occupy until full payment?
There's nothing specifically in there that says that they have the right to occupy until full payment. However, that the plain language of the contract itself, it would be contradictory that my clients would pay for a home and then not be able to have rights to the home when it says that this contract must be completed
Ms. Olson,
by 2041.
Ms. Olson, I think what you're referring to is, but for the fact that they had an appendix here and a normal contract for deed, you're just saying general matter when it's paid off, you get a warranty deed. But obviously your client isn't the reality by this record. Your clients never would have been able to purchase the property by contract or otherwise, but for the life estate. And that was made clear. So the whole point being it was unique from the beginning in that the vendor would have exclusive right to it. And then they invited your clients to live in it after they were married in the basement. But the reality is from the beginning, they would not have purchased it, but for the agreement that it would be a life estate to the grand from their grandparents.
I guess I would respectfully disagree on that issue. I agree that my clients would not have been able to purchase it, but for the fact that they were working with the grandparents. But I don't think the life estate and any promise of it is the sole reason why my clients would have been able to have this purchase. They created a contract for deed with.
Well, but all I'm getting at is that from your argument, I was trying to get understand it as well, is that the normal situation, which this has nothing to resemble a normal situation of a contract for deed, is that, and it's replete in the court's findings, that but for the life estate, they wouldn't have sold, the bottom line. And so that followed from the contract for deed to the warranty deed. And so what you're referring to is no particular provision of the contract for deed terms. But in general real estate law, you're saying at the point in which you get a warranty deed, then they somehow, the Lings could no longer live there. That's in a nutshell what you're saying.
That is correct.
So we would have to ignore the appendix to the contract for deed and the appendix to the warranty deed to come to that conclusion.
I don't think we would have to ignore it because further part of the contingency of the alleged life estate is that the Lings would have had the ability, the physical ability to remain in their home. And that clearly wasn't there as the home became in disrepair. The home was deteriorating. And per their contract and their requirements, they were to maintain and repair the home. I think there is significant evidence that the failure to do that shows an inability for them to remain in the home physically. And it's not just choose to do so under that provision, it's and are physically able to do so.
I didn't see any factual finding, though, that the court made that they were not physically, or at least grandpa, maybe grandma, I can't remember, was not physically able to be there. But your client did win on the maintenance and repair on the breach. And so that I assume you would want us to affirm, but I didn't see anything about lack of ability to live there.
I don't think there was a blatant, explicit statement of it, but I think the fact that our clients won on the issue of maintenance and repair and them not completing it properly does go into this issue of properly so long as they choose and are physically able to do so, which is on page 9 of the contract. Again, a life estate, it has an additional contingency. I agree, we're not in a normal contract for deed situation. There are some different provisions in here, but even within the warranty deed, it had that same issue. The fact is that the Lings were not able to maintain the home. They were not able to physically live there properly and do so in a manner that would make sense. There was never a part of the contract, or it was never designed in the contract that the Lings were allowed to remain in the home and just let the home go into disrepair, and they could continue to live there and do a property that's maintain the property. That's why we have that provision in there. And in this case, there were issues.
But that just goes into contract. That doesn't go into whether their life estate terminated. And in fact, we have case law going back to the early 1900s that says, unless you place a term of years, it's a life estate that's created. Whether you can bring a claim for waste as the, you know, residual holders of title to the property, or whether you can bring breach of contract claims like that. I mean, that does not allow you to extinguish the life estate itself.
That is correct. But we say that under this contract, by saying that this contract had to be paid by December 1st, 2041, and a warranty deed would be then given to my client.
But that
client.
Was not the argument that was made to the district court.
I believe the plain language of it is that there wasn't an established life estate. If there was considered a life estate and this court were to accept it, I believe it isn't created again because we have, per the plain language of a contract for deed, that this needed to be completed by 2041, which does give a term. It does set them up, and then a warranty deed would be given to my clients, which would mean they are the occupants and owners of that home. The fact that they paid early and there was no provision in there that said they couldn't, again, it sped up the process, but there is a term in there that allowed the Lings to essentially stay potentially until 2041 if no payment had been fully made prior.
Ms. Olson, I know we've talked about this for a length, but I just wanted to come at it from one different direction. Would you agree at minimum that you would have a better argument if there was no exhibit B to the warranty deed with the same language?
I think I would agree that is the bad fact for this case. I don't think it overturns the argument that we have, though, that a real life estate hadn't been fully established here. Further, and kind of going into the other arguments, we did have a request to reverse the court's summary judgment finding that we did not prove waste because we didn't allege malice. I think that goes against the contrary to Minnesota law, which is that we don't have to have full descriptive pleadings. We were very specific in our pleadings saying, asking for treble damages due to waste. So there was notice.
On that topic, would you agree that to show waste, to succeed on a waste claim, there must be evidence of more than just normal wear and tear, normal depreciation?
We agree, Your Honor. And if we had been given the opportunity, we would have had shown evidence of that.
At the summary judgment stage, did you include any evidence of that?
I believe at that stage or that issue, it was just whether or not we had pled.
Oh, it was on the pleading. Sorry.
Yes.
Are you sure?
Maybe
I'm wrong.
No, this was a motion for summary judgment, correct? I mean, at a motion for summary judgment, you have an obligation at that stage to show the district court what evidence you have.
Yes, but what I'm saying is the argument that was made before and what the district court found was not actually regarding summary judgment saying that we didn't have the evidence. It was the...
Oh, I thought the district court went beyond just the malice piece in its order. So can you address my question? What argument, what evidence was there at summary judgment to show more than just normal wear and tear?
Yes, I believe the additional information that we were talking about was the significant damage besides the alleged wear and tear. It was that the home had deteriorated to a point that it was not being fixed properly per the contract, and it was more than just they weren't able to do so. It was that they weren't doing it. They were purposefully not doing it, and specifically... And I just want to make sure I'm listing the right issues. It was that they allowed the shop building and the siding to rot. That isn't just wear and tear. That is actually not doing something, omitting to do something to allow it. The chimney bricks were crumbling. They did not fix the chimney. That, again, is a significant issue. That the woodwork in the home was damaged. Decks were rotting. This is not just wear and tear.
And was there evidence that all this occurred post 2017.
I see I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I believe the issue of waste does not necessarily require the provision of the as is. I think that goes to a different section, but when we're talking about waste, if they are purposefully and maliciously, in our opinion, allowing these things to continue to deteriorate, and they would have had to be. This isn't a situation where it started out with a rotting shop building. I mean, we had an appraisal that showed that there was enough damage that there was about $90,000 of additional money that could have been made, but for the fact that these things were not being taken care of properly. This is not something that was found to be there as of 2017. The court found that this continued to happen. That's why we won the claim of maintaining and repairing, and waste goes towards that. But again, the issue became that there was a claim we didn't plead it properly, and I don't believe that that is accurate as we requested the issue of waste.
Judge Cochran, I have a couple of questions on the breach of contract claim. Could I ask them?
Sure. Yep, go ahead.
Counsel, do you agree with the district court's interpretation of the interaction between the as-is clause and the repair and maintenance that that your clients purchased the property as it existed in 2017? And so any damage to the property that appellants were responsible for had to exist after 2017. Do you agree with the district court's interpretation of the contract?
We do agree with the interpretation that my client bought as is, and the as is would have been at the date of purchase in 2017. And then anything after that, or I would say additional disrepair. So if something started disrepaired, but it got worse, then I think the district court properly applied that the maintenance and repair clauses of that contract then applied. And I believe the Lings also conceded to that point by saying they didn't fulfill that duty.
And then do you agree with appellant that your clients bore the burden both on the waste claim and the breach of contract claim to present evidence of what the property looked like in 2017 in order to prove those claims?
I don't believe let me make sure I'm being clear. I agree that we would hold the burden because we were the ones who were making those claims. So we do have the burden. I think through the testimony and showing through the appraisal that there was additional money that was basically lost because of this, established enough that this was an after the fact continued disrepair.
Are you talking about the $100,000 depreciation value?
Yes, I'm talking about the 2020 appraisal and showing the differences, while the market forces allow
which is
the
called
home...
which they call depreciation and doesn't identify any particular things, correct?
Yes, that is correct. We believe that while it doesn't specifically state that, the evidence of the disrepairs and the statements and testimony made at trial can clearly show that it was an issue of waste as well as an issue of breaching their contract by failing to repair and maintain.
And then can you point me, is there anywhere in the record where your clients actually presented evidence as to how the chimney, the decks, and the siding looked in 2017? Did your clients present any evidence as to how those particular things looked in 2017?
I don't believe we provided any pictures. I believe there were just discussions of how the home was deteriorated after the fact.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel for respondents. Counsel for appellants, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I think the court recognized the heart of the breach of contract claims here. The Lings wouldn't have sold if they didn't have the right to stay. The Revere's knew that. They promised that they'd allow them to stay. Because of that knowledge and because of those promises, their decision to pursue eviction was a breach of the contract. Now, not every declaratory judgment action or on the terms of a life estate would be a breach of contract. The reason that it was here is because of those surrounding promises and the things that led up to the execution of the contract and the acceptance of the payoff. As for the Revere's waste claims, there are a couple points that I'd like to address. First of all, counsel was talking about money that could have been made and money that was lost. But again, this was a property that not only was purchased as is and with all faults, but purchased at a substantial discount, several hundred thousand dollars less than this market price they keep talking about.
How does the purchase price go into the waste claim or relate to the waste claim?
Well, it relates to the waste claim in the following fashion. Once again, when we're talking about waste, we are talking about harm beyond ordinary depreciation, and we are talking about harm that is done to the property that is damage beyond the ordinary. So the reason that these things matter is because when you look at the actual farm, you are not seeing anything that under the terms of Minnesota law would qualify as waste. Waste is egregious. You look at the farm, what it appraised at shows it is worth well more than what they paid. And what they paid in part was accepting what they got. What they paid was as is. The fact that they had a discount means that if you are coming back and saying, well, wait a minute, this farm is not perfect, the answer to that is essentially, look, you weren't paying full price on this, and you were taking exact things exactly as they were. No question about fixing anything before you took it. You took it as it was. And again, the additional relevance on the purchase price is the fact that when you look at this farm, when the bank looked at this farm, when the appraiser looked at this farm, nobody saw any egregious issues. And that in and of itself is proof that no waste had occurred.
Counsel, my question on the waste claim is, do you think that there is a legal tension between the district court refusing to or granting summary judgment on the waste claim and the ultimate decision that your clients did in fact breach the contract with regard to maintaining some of these properties? Why couldn't that have been, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, why couldn't that have also been evidence of, you know, negligence on the part of your clients to maintain the property?
Well, because when you look at the cases where waste has actually been found, waste is indeed going above and beyond ordinary wear and tear. Arguably, and I don't believe it's true in this case for reasons we've already stated, the, you know, damages that occurred as ordinary wear and tear might be subject to repair if they happen after the contract. But if you're looking at waste, waste in the case law, every time, it is something huge, it is something ugly, it is something that is destructive to the property versus ordinary use and ordinary passage of time. Ordinary passage of time might necessitate repair, but ordinary passage of time is not waste. And that, I believe, resolves any possible tension between the two. Chase and Shelby started this case because they wanted to get more than they paid for. All we're asking for today is that this court correct the trial court's errors and give Chase and Shelby what they deserve.
Any further questions from the panel? All right, thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe. Have a great day.
Thank you.